On last week's Jury Break, we interviewed a subject from the BDSM community. This week we're interviewing someone from the legal community, Kelvin Fisher. Here's what you're going to hear in this episode. Kelvin is going to explain the difference between civil and criminal juries before going into detail about the process of jury selection and how people are stricken for cause. What constitutes a need to be stricken for cause in the court's eyes? And the possibilities for why a couple of strong-minded jurors in the Samantha Hall trial, Mandy and Carl, were not dismissed from jury selection. Finally, he's going to offer his own insight into an evidentiary element of the case he thinks the jury might be missing. Please enjoy this ad-free Jury Break.
So, Kelvin, could you please explain who you are and what you do for a living?
Yes, I'm a civil litigation attorney in the Kansas City metropolitan area. The easiest way for me to describe what I do is I sue people and I defend people who get sued.
Simple and to the point. I like it.
Yes.
So how often do you interact with juries as part of your job?
In the civil arena, it doesn't happen near as frequent as it used to. Approximately 97% of civil cases get resolved pre-suit, and that's either by a settlement, dismissal, and so forth. So the last jury trial that I had was about approximately 4 years ago. There's been a lot of close calls where we get up to the day of trial and then it resolves. So, but I have conducted several jury trials over the 13 years that I have been practicing now.
Okay, great. What's the difference between a criminal and a civil jury?
The criminal jury is set up essentially to determine the guilt or whether an accused defendant is guilty or not guilty. Not guilty, I think, is there's a distinction between not guilty and innocent. Not guilty, I think, mean basically the prosecution didn't meet their burden of proof, as opposed to the defendant, not actually having committed the crime that they're accused of. The difference between criminal and civil is, whereas criminal jury trials are set up to determine that the guilt or appropriate punishment if guilt is determined, civil trials, the purpose of those is to seek monetary awards. I have several friends who are criminal attorneys, and I would say that probably the biggest distinction between their practice and my practice is in their cases, they oftentimes have somebody's freedom, even their life on the line, whereas as a civil litigation attorney, my cases are generally about dollars and cents. Another key difference is that criminal jury trials generally require a unanimous verdict. All jurors have to vote in favor of a particular verdict, whereas in civil jury trials, depending on the jurisdiction, a unanimous verdict is not always required.
Right. Right. We've had occasion to speak previously a little bit about juries in general and jury trials. And I asked you what you thought one of the biggest issues was facing the jury system today. Do you remember what you said to me?
Yes. One of the biggest problems I think that confronts the jury trial system today is the inconsistency in how jurors are struck for cause. In a jury trial, a judge can strike a potential juror for cause for a variety of reasons during the course of jury selection. For instance, if it becomes apparent that a particular juror is biased and won't be able to set aside those biases, a judge can strike a juror for cause either at the request of the prosecutor or the defense attorney, or the judge may do that, of his or her own accord if they determine that this particular juror should be struck for cause. Some other reasons why jurors may be struck for cause is if the juror knows the attorneys who are involved in the case, or if they know the parties, or if they know potential witnesses, the judge, maybe another court staff. Juror might be stricken for cause if they have health problems that would impact their ability to be able to serve as a juror with reasonable accommodations. Mm-hmm. In the context of a criminal case, one of the things that the judge really needs to consider when determining whether to strike for cause is the whether a juror is able to fairly determine guilt or innocence and an appropriate punishment. For example, if there's a death penalty case and a juror, potential jurors, in response to questioning says, yes, if this defendant is convicted, I will sentence him to him or her to death. That may indicate a juror's unwillingness to fairly consider other potential sentences such as life without parole. Mm-hmm. And this actually goes both ways. I don't know if you've had opportunity to read The Innocent Man by John Grisham. It's actually, I believe it's the only nonfiction book that he's written. And it was about two individuals who were convicted of murder in Pontotoc County, Oklahoma. Ada, Oklahoma is where the murder occurred. And one of them was sentenced to life in prison. The other one was sentenced to death. And they were ultimately exonerated due to DNA evidence. And the DNA also disclosed the individual who committed the murder. And so after their conviction was overturned, this individual was put on trial. My dad lives in Pontotoc County, Oklahoma. So he was called as a potential juror for the murder trial of the individual whose DNA matched the murder scene. During the course of the jury selection process, the jurors were asked if they could impose the death penalty if this defendant was found to be guilty. And in answering that, my dad said he couldn't. Consequently, he was struck from cause from that jury.
I see. Okay, so it sounds like there are a lot of factors that could influence someone being struck for cause. Conflict of interest, sort of like personal beliefs, any biases that exist. Would you think that's fair to say that all of those would influence whether or not someone could be struck for cause during jury selection?
Yes, that is very accurate.
Okay. Well, so as this podcast has been airing, a lot of listeners have described shock or displeasure at a couple of the jurors that were selected for this jury. And in particular, I'm talking about Carl. For those who aren't familiar with the name or just haven't caught his name during the deliberations, he's the very conservative, religiously minded voice in the group. On the other side of the coin, there's Mandy, who is sort of the liberal, pro not guilty voice in the room. Both of them have very strong opinions. Carl especially seems to wrought a lot of controversy amongst listeners. And I keep hearing, like, how did this guy make jury selection? How is it possible that he wasn't struck for jury selection? I don't understand it. And so I was really hoping that I could speak to someone like you who might be able to speak to why or why not someone like Carl would be admitted to this jury.
Yeah, and I can definitely do that. And it's really not as uncommon as you might think that somebody like Carl could end up on a jury such as this. During the jury selection process, there's a possibility that Carl, in response to questioning, could have expressed bias against Samantha. I think it's pretty clear, from listening to the deliberations, that there is somewhat of a bias that Carl has against Samantha. So if during the course of the jury selection process he expressed bias, the prosecutor obviously is going to pick up on that and is going to want Carl to be a potential juror. So what they will try to do is what's called a rehabilitate to rehabilitate Carl, essentially try to ask questions to basically ascertain from Carl that he could, despite his biases, set aside those biases and render a fair and just verdict in the case. Now, the problem with that is, everybody has life experiences, and if we have certain biases that have built up over a lifetime, it's not necessarily as easy as, I'll put that aside and not take that in consideration. So say that Carl expressed his bias during the jury selection process. Of course, the defense attorney is going to say, judge, he needs to be stricken for cause. Prosecutor may have asked questions wherein she was able to get Carl to say that I can be a fair juror in this case. And if the judge thinks that Carl's been properly rehabilitated, then, it's possible that Carl might not be stricken for cause, which then, which causes a dilemma for the defense attorney. In most cases, both sides get what are called peremptory strikes. You get a certain amount of strikes. You can get rid of a juror for whatever reason. And so say with Carl, if the defense attorney, doesn't like Carl and the judge won't strike Carl for cause, the defense attorney has to, make the decision. Do I use this peremptory strike to get rid of him, or do I use their peremptory strike to get rid of another potential juror who might be even more problematic than Carl? Another way that jurors such as Carl and, Mandy, for that matter, can get on a jury panel is they're what I call the silent jurors. During the jury selection process, they answered few to no questions, and so this could result for a variety of reasons. They don't respond to a question that they should have responded to for whatever reason, embarrassment, not wanting to come across as narrow-minded, a desire to be involved in the case and notoriety, just not wanting to be removed for whatever reason. And so, to use Carl, keep on picking on Carl here, to use him as an example, he obviously has some very strong feelings about Ms. Hall, but it's possible that during the jury selection process he didn't express those as strongly as he's doing in the jury room because he didn't want to come across to everybody there in open court as somebody, who's unreasonable. That's another way that someone like Carl can end up on the juror. And then if you're faced with this situation where you have a juror who hasn't really answered questions, and you really don't have much of a knowledge base regarding when it comes time to actually pick the jury, the prosecutor and defense attorney may find themselves faced with a scenario where they really don't know much about the particular juror. And so due to the lack of knowledge, they don't have a strong basis to ask that the juror be stricken for cause. But then they find themselves wondering, well, do I need to use a peremptory cause for this juror or for somebody else? And, if it gets to that situation and there's somebody who seems, at least, from the defense perspective, to be, for lack of a better term, a worse juror than Carl, the defense might use their peremptory strike with regard to that juror, thus, enabling Carl to end up on the panel. And sometimes silent jurors, it can occur whenever, the simple reason that a juror might not hear or understand a question that's being asked by the attorneys during jury selection.
My God, it sounds like there's a lot of ambiguity during jury selection and possibility for and inconsistencies and just like the chance for things to go wrong potentially.
Right.
Because it sounds like, and I'm just recapping, so let me know if I got all of that correctly, but it sounds like if someone does express bias during jury selection while they're being interviewed, the other attorney has the ability to, like, massage the trajectory of that discussion into making them sound less biased, and that you call that rehabilitation, which is interesting. I'd never heard that. And then otherwise there are, like, silent jurors who may not be asked the question, or for whatever reason they're just not being outspoken about any potential biases they'd have, or, you know, they might intentionally misrepresent themselves because, you know, for whatever reason they don't want to seem biased, or they really want to serve on the jury. You know, they have that option open to them. And lastly, even if they are completely biased and outspoken about it, if one side runs out of peremptory challenges and the judge disagrees that there's cause there that would allow this person to be stricken, like, all of those reasons would allow someone potentially unfit to serve on a jury.
Yes, that is very accurate.
Wow. Okay. I'm a little surprised. Like, I thought that it would just sort of come down to, I thought this discussion would come down to, like, oh, a judge versus a lawyer disagreeing about, you know, what's cause and what's not. And then I understood peremptory challenges in advance and sort of like a limited number to those, but I didn't realize there was quite a catalog of options available to attorneys to get specific jurors they'd like to serve to be selected. So, wow.
Yes.
Thank you for enlightening me as to all of those. So you did mention to me previously, in our brief, email correspondence that when you were listening to the show, you were surprised by, things that jurors focus on that lawyers don't think are relevant, or vice versa. So I'm just wondering if you could expand on that.
Yes. And I believe it was the last episode, the jurors were discussing the stool that was at issue, and they all pretty much just said they didn't feel that was all that significant. Whereas I, you know, at least with my legal hat on, from the outset of this case, I've always thought there was a tremendous significance to the stool, so much that, and without having heard all the evidence, in this particular case, the footstool to me means, the difference between her acquittal and the lesser charge. So far, I haven't seen enough that would make me think that she's guilty of first-degree murder, but I find the footstool to be very problematic for Ms. Hall. And it was just interesting to me that the jurors had a completely different approach to that, and they didn't really focus on it much at all.
That's true. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly, because I was sitting in the room during those deliberations when they were passing around evidence, and I don't even think that the footstool made it around the table. Like, it seemed to be discarded pretty quickly during that process. And as you noted, it really wasn't discussed very much at all. It didn't seem to be deemed relevant. Why do you think that it's so relevant?
And it's not necessarily just the footstool in and of itself. It was the instruction to kick it away, and that's what I'm struggling with that text. That seems to indicate something. It potentially indicates something a little more than just an accident. It may. You rise to the level of recklessness, not quite saying that there was a malicious intent there, but I think that that instruction to kick the stool away, it's impacted the way I view the case, because initially, I think after probably for a couple of episodes, I was really strong on just not guilty, but I keep going back to that stool and that instruction to kick the stool away. Right. So I just found it interesting that that the jurors that was not much of a consideration for them.
Right. So, I mean, I think if I'm recalling correctly, what the jurors said, well, since his toes were somewhat on the floor, I mean, there's a debate as to like whether or not his feet were on the floor enough to be weight bearing, but then she did approximate the height of the footstool, et cetera, correctly. So therefore it wasn't relevant. But if I'm understanding your point now correctly, you would have felt differently if instead of saying kick the footstool away, Samantha Hall said step off of the footstool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
The problem, you know, that I'm struggling with is the specific language of the instruction. Kick the footstool away, as opposed to okay, get up on the stool, step down, and then so forth.
Right. I think the footstool itself hasn't really been raised that often, either in the deliberations room or I saw it come up in the Facebook group recently, but again, it really hasn't been a point of focus. So it's interesting to me, especially with you with the legal background, to really kind of be drawn to that as being a central focus for this argument.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I feel like that was a really enlightening talk. I learned a lot about jury selection, especially, which now I'm eager to dive into that a bit more. Before we sign off, is there anything that you like would like to plug? If anyone wants to find you on Twitter or seek professional guidance with your company, or is there anything like that?
Yes, I'm a litigation attorney with Wallace Saunders. We are headquartered in Overland Park, Kansas, which is it's in the Kansas City metropolitan area. Our website is Wallace Saunders. That's saunders.com. If anybody ever has any legal issues that they might need assistance with, I can be my contact information is right there on my profile on the website.
Fantastic. And again, your name is Kelvin Fisher. Or it is, yes. Kelvin Fisher.
I'm not. Yes. To... yeah, that's K-E-L-V-I-N, because I get called Calvin and Kevin a lot, so.
Yeah, I imagine so. I like the name Kelvin. It's unique.
Oh, thank you. I like
it. Well, thank you again so much, Kelvin, for taking the time and for putting so much thought and energy into this discussion, because I've learned a lot, and I hope our audience has found a lot of it to be as valuable as I have.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to do it.
I look forward to exploring other legal issues, as well as revealing other realities about the BDSM lifestyle in future jury breaks. But first, in 2 days, I drop episode 8, Manslaughter. The jury examines the charge of manslaughter. The prosecution leans on Samantha's suspicious choice of rope, as well as its purchase date. Troy reassures Samantha about his commitment to safety in a text exchange. Thank you for listening. See you in 2 days.